Hi, this is John Udell. My guest today is Bill Crow, who for the last 5 years has been working on HD Photo, a new file format that's intended to supplant JPEG as the foundation of digital photography. I first met Bill many years ago when I was at Byte magazine, and he was working on HP New Wave, which may have been the first attempt to produce an object-oriented file system for Windows, originally, believe it or not, for Windows 1.0. The connection between New Wave and HD Photo is tenuous, but it does exist, in the sense that the kinds of metadata strategies we're evolving now offer some hope of finally breaking free from the tyranny of the hierarchical file system. We talked a bit about the history of that problem, but most of the interview focuses on HD Photo. What was the motivation for it? How does it work? What does it mean for both amateur and professional photographers? How will it be standardized? And when will we see cameras that produce photos in HD Photo format?
Hi, John. It's Bill Crow.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Good.
Gosh, I'm trying to think when the last time we spoke would have been, and I'm going to guess.
It was a little earlier this afternoon.
Well, I mean before that. I'm going to guess in potentially the late 80s, because I'm thinking that New Wave was before Windows 3.0.
Yeah, it was. Well, we started New Wave on Windows 1.0. That's when we started doing the work. Actually, we were working with an alpha version of Windows 1.0. We used to jokingly call it Window
in those days
because the multitasking was very unstable.
Well, so we want to wind this around to HD Photo, but you know, since I've got you on the subject of New Wave, and since it's been almost 20 years, but in some ways things haven't changed so much, I thought it would just be interesting to kind of review. I'm sure a lot of people aren't, you know, old enough to even remember what that was, right?
What does that say about you and me?
it says that we're old farts, you know, which means we get to do old farty things like talk about the distant past, you know.
Yeah.
But in fact, I would claim that it's all completely relevant, right? That all of those ideas were important then, they remain important now, and it's not like we've kind of nailed all that stuff yet either. So I mean, my recollection of it was that it was, you know, of course, a Windows shell, but it also had some pretty ambitious ideas about things like unique object identity, about just generally object orientation. I remember it had a whole scripting language inside of it for manipulating those objects. It had kind of a notion of agents, actually, in it as well, didn't it?
Very explicitly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were two major technological foundations to it. The first was the OMF, the Object Management Facility, essentially an object-oriented file system, if you will,
but
at a lower granularity than we think of a file system today. And then the Agent Facility, which was essentially just a cross-scripting macro language. The whole concept of the Agent Facility is we logically thought of an application in two components, its functional component and its user interface, and that there was a well-defined language for how the user interface communicated to the functional component what it needed to be done, and likewise how the functional component communicated back to the user interface how that should be rendered or displayed on the screen.
Right.
The design of the agent facility, this cross-application scripting language, was not to just drive the user interface, but was to speak to the functionality of the application.
Right.
And you know, we certainly see that today in scripting facilities built into a lot of applications. The whole goal of New Wave was to try to normalize that so all applications worked, you know, in a consistent way.
So where did that come from? How did you come to be involved with all that in the first place?
Well, I was part of the PC software division at Hewlett-Packard, and prior to working on New Wave, this was in the earliest days of personal computers now, so this would have been, you know, in the early 80s. I think I joined HP probably in 83, 84, that time frame, and we were just introducing the HP 150, which was an 8080-based PC, but I put PC in lowercase. It was not IBM PC compatible. It didn't use the same BIOS. And again, these were in the earliest days. Hewlett-Packard's goal was to innovate. And so it was a touchscreen graphics display system. It had all kinds of other advances beyond what was the generic PC. In the long run, it only lasted a few years because the demand for PC compatibility became paramount. And so HP eventually went down that path. But in looking at the role of PCs as a component in a business environment, and the same thing kind of held true today for consumer use too, but at that time, You know, we didn't even really have an internet. You know, people weren't using web browsers and things. But networks were absolutely being used in business. And so we were sharing files over networks. We were using email to move data. And as a PC became the client for that, we could boil this down to a really simple problem. As I wanted to create a document and put a chart in it and mail it to you.
Yeah.
And the typical way that was done in the earliest days of PCs was that the reference to a chart, you know, was a pointer to another file that was elsewhere on the disk. So when I emailed you the document file, the chart essentially fell out the bottom because all you got was a pointer to a file, not the file itself.
This whole compound document question remains very much alive even today.
Yeah, and well, this was back in the earliest days of it. And so at the heart of it, that was the root problem we set out to solve. How can we, you know, make PCs a useful client in this distributed business environment if the data is in these, you know, separate files, and so, you know, we've tasked the user with having to gather up all these files and get them there.
Yeah.
How can you build, you know, a document or another, you know, a document's the best example, but build output that includes sources from multiple applications and keep them all glued together?
Yeah.
And really the heart of the problem back then, and, you know, and this is what's so interesting about it, because it kind of still exists today, is the file system. You know, we've basically lived with the same basic file system since the very first PCs, this hierarchical directory structure.
Yep.
And kind of, if I was to pin one single root of the problem, is there's only one way we refer to a file, and that's by a file name.
Yeah.
So the file name that the user has complete control over and is responsible for is also the way that, in the case of the simple compound document, you know, one application talking to another, they refer to the file.
Yeah.
So we have the situation that we could build up these complex links, but the user is perfectly free to go in there and rename files and move files and delete files, totally oblivious to any of the dependencies there might be on how things are linked together by these names, and destroy all those links and break those compound documents. So if you think about it, what really goes on in a file system is there's a whole layer below the directory names and the directory structure where the file system itself keeps track of the sector on the disk and the pointer to that sector. And as a user, we never touch that. We touch it at a higher level, but we don't go down to that low level. And that's the only way that the operating system can maintain the integrity of the file system at the level we view it.
Right.
Well, what New Wave was all about was putting another layer of abstraction above that. So we treat information, objects of information, you know, bits and pieces of information, which is largely a file, but we treat it as an object within this object management system. The user then was exposed to them and dealt with them as objects, not as the underlying files in the file system, and the object management facility, New Wave, hid that abstraction, the actual where is the file and where is it stored in the directory and what's the actual file name, was hidden from the user in much the same way, you know, what's the sector ID and the location on the disk of that data hidden, you know, by a file system.
Yeah, and to do that, so you had your own layer of unique IDs for files, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you will, a database, very much an object-oriented database. And so that gave us instantly some really cool, powerful things. When the name of the file at that point was nothing but paint, it was the description on the outside for the user's benefit. It had nothing to do with where the file was located or how we might be linked to it.
Yeah.
And so we gave the user the freedom to rename files. And of course, this was back in the days of, you know, Windows 2.0, so, you know, that included giving them the ability for long file names, which didn't even exist back then.
Yeah.
And users could freely move files around and indeed put the same file in three different folders.
Oh, that's the thing, right? I mean, that's the thing that to this day is still, in a way, very new to people. I mean, there's glimpses of it. There were glimpses of it in Outlook, for example, where you could have a search folder and something would be the same thing, but it showed up in a different place.
Yep.
It's kind of been sneaking up on people. And actually, that's one of the most fascinating things about the whole Vista setup to me, is that it begins to create that bridge. I mean, less ambitiously than it was originally intended to do, but it begins to create that bridge from this world of containment and hierarchy to this world where, and I think it's clearest actually in Photo Gallery, right, where you sort of move from the hierarchy of files to this tag world. It's fascinating to me, you know, to kind of watch this conceptual bridge being built between these two completely different paradigms.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're starting to see happen. And again, in Photo Gallery, and even in Windows in a broader sense, but you're absolutely right, it's very much the model of operation in Photo Gallery. That level of abstraction is created through metadata and metadata tags.
Yeah.
I don't physically organize files in directories, the physical structure on the disk. I organize things in a level of abstraction with metadata tags, and I can mix and match and easily change them and group them in different ways, and I don't care where things are physically stored anymore.
Right.
The challenge we have still today, I think, in Vista is the same challenge we had back then, is for that to really work, it's a whole new paradigm. And so, you know, we have to switch completely to that new paradigm, whereas if you're trying to straddle the fence back in the days of New Wave, the straddling the fence was dealing with lots of applications that didn't understand this object-oriented database, that they still expected things to be in known file names and known directories.
Yeah, but we're still straddling that fence, and the reality is that you can't sort of make that leap in one go.
That's what's just, I find stunning sometimes when I sit back and think about it, is that was 20 years ago, and here's this same problem still biting at the heels, you know, that you know, at the root of it, just entropy is, you know, and the difficulty to change a well-established environment, you know, just keeps us tied to that fundamental hierarchical file directory system.
Yeah.
And it's in many ways, I believe, is a huge inhibitor to a whole world of innovation. And you said it right. We see glimpses of what could be in things that are available today, but I don't think we've begun to realize that full potential.
Right.
I think the search capability that is in Vista today is another way that we expose that potential. And it's been revolutionary for me and really changed the way I do things, is all of a sudden I don't care that much where the folders are, and I'm not so anal about keeping everything neatly organized in folders. Things tend to go now on my desktop, you know, in a lot of just bigger flat folders, you know, just big collections of stuff. And I use search to find things, not, you know, working my way down through a hierarchical directory structure.
Yeah. And of course, people have been having this experience a lot on the web, and the transplantation of it to the desktop is a pretty interesting thing. And then even more interesting is, again, sort of how do we bridge those domains, right? You know, how do we make that experience cross the boundary between the web and the desktop in an interesting and useful way?
Yep.
That's
one dimension of that is, you know, you see in Outlook, you know, where they provide, you know, it provides, well, it's tied with Vista and Outlook, where search is integrated across those two.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the idea that could extend from local and the web domain.
A nice example, and it kind of bridges all the way forward now to your work with HD Photo, is one of the things that I did a little investigation around when I first started with Microsoft, actually, was the way in which metadata is embedded in files. In a couple of cases, so well in the photo domain, it's embedded in some of the file formats, so that this XMP, this Adobe metadata format, XML stuff is, I'm sure you know, is you know, actually in the JPEGs and a couple of the other image formats,
right.
And it's that way with the Office XML stuff too. But in the case of the photos, you know, I thought that was just really interesting, because what it meant was that where in perhaps an earlier generation of this idea, what would have happened is you would have done all of this tagging on your photos, but the tags would be kind of wired into your instance of your operating system and your desktop, right? And then if you uploaded those image files to someplace, that metadata investment that you had made would be gone. But with this arrangement, it's not. So in principle, you could upload your photos that you had tagged in Photo Gallery up to, say, Flickr, and it could absorb those tags, and they could appear and function in the cloud. And I thought that was just really interesting.
It clearly was a very deliberate and difficult, but, you know, focused effort in the creation of Vista, specifically the photo experience in Vista, to accomplish that.
Yeah.
I'll try not to do this too much, but to go back to New Wave, if indeed we had an object-oriented environment as opposed to this essentially dumb file system under there, we could solve that problem much more elegantly by simply subclassing a basic storage class as a photo storage class and adding all of the appropriate properties for that to contain all that metadata.
Yeah.
And then manipulating objects would always keep that metadata in place.
Yeah.
But because of the fact that the user can just reach down there and grab an individual file by its file name and copy that, the requirement to really make metadata do what you want it to do, what you just described, is the metadata has to get inside that file.
Yeah.
And so the phrase that we just, it was the mantra.
The truth is in the file.
The truth is in the file.
That's I did a whole riff on that on the blog and looked at it from a couple of different perspectives, and it generated quite an interesting conversation around a couple of blog entries of mine along those lines, because it was funny, actually, because over the years I had run into a number of different formulations. One of them was, the truth is on the wire, right? One of them was, the truth is in the database, and one of them is, the truth is in the file. There are many truths, and
it's a challenge, because you build a photo manipulation, a photo management application, you know, whether it's Photo Gallery or whether it's Bridge in Photoshop or iPhoto on the Mac. You know, and it's just this constant dilemma and trade-off that if you keep a central database for all that information,
right,
separate from the files, you get some tremendous gains and some tremendous opportunities.
Yep.
But now the truth isn't in the file anymore. It's off, yeah, in a database.
Yeah.
And if someone reaches under the skin, i.e. just brings up a File Explorer window and moves or copies a file,
right,
you've really corrupted, or, you know, at a minimum, you've lost, you know, that investment in describing the file through metadata.
Yeah.
But the other challenge, you know, we really faced is it's not just, there's two levels to it. There's the mechanical problem of, well, how do you put the bits inside this file? What's the particular syntax or the particular structure for this type of file versus that type of file? Then above that, there's also the schema problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now in the world of photography, we have EXIF metadata, we have XMP metadata,
yeah,
we have TIFF IFD tags,
yeah,
we have IPTC, and every one of them has some equivalent of caption or description.
Yeah, so apparently the solution is support everything that moves, at least for now.
And not only support everything that moves, but, you know, supporting it is this huge problem of, you basically have to have, and we do have in Vista, a very sophisticated policy layer that says, okay, if I find this information in three different tags, who wins?
Right.
You know, what's
right,
the rule?
Right.
And when I want to write the information back, how do I write it back to that? And so there was a huge investment in Vista to define this very complex policy layer for how we make sense out of all that, when, in fact, the real need here is to undo some of the madness of all of these different metadata formats that have simply evolved incrementally over time. And that's an ongoing effort that with Microsoft and the industry is, you know, how we can improve on that in the long run.
To kind of bring this forward then, many years pass, and I discover that you're at Microsoft and you're doing HD photo, which I guess doesn't stand for high def?
It doesn't stand for anything. HD photo is the name for this new file format. We chose it for a couple reasons. It's actually also known as Windows Media Photo.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, it got called Windows Media Photo totally by default. Microsoft already has a trademark on Windows Media. It was real easy to just add photo to the end as opposed to video or audio.
Start with, what was the motivation for it in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Why in the world do we need another file format, an image file format or a photo file format? I worked came in at the very tail end, but I worked on the photo experience that is in Windows XP. So the bits and pieces in XP specifically for photography, the camera acquisition wizard, the photo printing wizard, the photo viewer itself.
Okay.
I managed as a program manager for the team that was responsible for all of that coolness in XP. And it really was a small amount we got into XP to essentially add the beginnings of a photo experience.
Mm-hmm.
The response was phenomenal. It became one of the more popular capabilities that was in XP. And so there was a strong desire moving forward. So this was in the earliest days of planning for Vista. We said, how do we improve on that? How are we going to build this and expand the photo experience? And we were looking at a wide range of things that we wanted to improve. One of those was photo quality. Our observation was there was a tremendous amount that could be done to just make digital photography produce higher quality results. And we looked at that kind of from two dimensions. One is the professional, the serious hobbyist that wanted to extract absolutely the highest quality that they could, and that path wasn't through a default Windows photo experience. That was shooting in RAW and using complex workflows and the printing side going through all kinds of lengths to kind of bypass components of the printing system with what are called RIP applications, raster image processing applications that talk directly to printers and bypass drivers. So that's one end that, okay, those guys are really want the best quality, and right now they have to do this really complex and bizarre workflow to get to that.
Yeah.
How can we make that level of quality more mainstream? And then the other end of the spectrum was, the consumer photographer, the nickname for that individual inside Microsoft in those days, probably still used today, is the happy snapper. Someone that just likes to whip that camera out and snap pictures, but certainly would like to get good quality pictures. And quite frankly, digital photography takes a step back from the world of film.
Oh, yeah.
You could go down to the drugstore, buy that cheap disposable camera, which had this really incredible Kodak film in it that captured a really wide latitude, and you didn't think about it. You whipped up the camera. There wasn't fancy knobs and settings and dials and modes and different controls. You just pushed the shutter button, took your picture. All the magic happened when you took that back to the drugstore and they developed that film, and that big fancy machine that created the prints has incredibly sophisticated image processing in it to dig out your terrible exposure with the wrong color balance that's captured on that wide latitude negative and figure out how to make a really good-looking picture out of it.
Which, by the way, that print that you walk away from the store with is probably going to last more than 100 years.
And there's a couple. There's technical aspects to that, and there's also just social aspects and how we think about photography,
yeah,
too. But once again, we diverge.
Yeah.
So the fact of the matter is, for those happy snappers, and many of us are that at one time or another, those photos you get back from the Kodak or the Fuji photo developing machine at your local Walmart or drugstore, that's not an accurate print of the image you captured on the negative. That is a very sophisticated algorithm manufacturing a good-looking picture from whatever garbage it could find on the negative. In some cases, it might have been a great exposure. In a lot of cases, they're not that great, and the machine automatically does all these adjustments and comes out with that photo.
Hmm.
Well, that's not where we are in digital photography. Pretty much, if you don't take a good photo from the camera, there's not a lot that can be done. There's some things that could be done, but not a tremendous amount that could be done to make it dramatically better, given that the camera gives it to you in the form of a JPEG file,
mm-hmm,
which is kind of a least common denominator, optimized to hopefully display well, but not containing a lot of data to allow you to do much adjustments or editing. That's why shooting in RAW is important to a lot of people that are more serious about image quality, is because a RAW file is the actual data that came from the sensor. It's not even a photo yet. It's just sensor data.
Mm.
But all the information that the sensor captured is there, and it provides the opportunity for greater control to adjust how that's translated into a nice red, green, blue, three-color channel color photo.
So are those basically the two options that there ever have been with Digicams, is JPEG and RAW?
No, there's some cameras that have existed over time that could save in TIFF files.
That's right. The very first ones that we had at Byte,
TIFF file was the camera still doing the image processing to convert RAW sensor data into a finished photo,
okay. But
not unleashing the harshness of compression, lossy compression from JPEG,
right,
on that photo. So if we were going to talk about in the audio world, the analogies are very straightforward. In the world of audio, most professional audio production now is done in a minimum of 24-bit depth, 48 or 96 kilohertz sample rates or more, when in fact the output from all of that is only a 16-bit depth, 44 kilohertz file, a Redbook audio CD.
Mm-hmm.
And then for MP3s, we then take that 16 8-bit 44 kilohertz signal, and we apply lossy compression, and we destroy it even more.
Although JPEGs could be uncompressed, right? If you, if you had the space to play with.
It sends us off kind of in another direction. In the what, when we say JPEG, we could be talking about so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
So JPEG is, on one hand, an organization. It's actually multiple organizations, but it's the Joint Photographic Experts Group,
mm-hmm.
and there's individual country organizations, which are standard-setting groups in those countries that all feed into the international JPEG organization, and they set the standard, and they produce what is ultimately the ISO standard, and there's documents available that can easily be downloaded. And within that JPEG standard, there's multiple modes, which include lossy compression and lossless compression, include color and monochrome up to 12-bit depth. But that's all very different than what we call a JPEG file. So when, you know, the file that comes out of your camera with a .jpg extension is actually a file that was defined by a different organization called, and I'm going to simplify things a little, but, you know, this is generally an accurate description of this, but you know, to keep this simple, we'll try to simplify it. Multiple groups are involved. But there's an organization called CIPA, the Camera Industry Products Association, which is a standard-setting organization that's actually based out of Japan. And this is the group that, you know, the fact that you can take a memory card out of one camera and stick it in another camera and the file format's the same and we can find the files, that DCIM directory structure and
right.
those specific 8-character file names,
right.
that's all defined by CIPA, and they have specifications and standards for all of that and many, many other aspects of digital cameras, which provide some level of compatibility and commonness.
Okay.
And CIPA has also defined what's called EXIF.
Yeah.
And so EXIF, we've heard EXIF because it talks about the metadata, but really what we call a JPEG file is an EXIF container structure that uses JPEG compression technology plus EXIF metadata inside it.
Got it.
It's kind of pulled together a bunch of these standards.
Okay.
And so in that definition, which is the definition that's used by all the camera manufacturers today, they've selected one component of the JPEG Standards Organization broader specification. And that one component is red, green, blue, lossy compression, 8-bit per channel.
Mm, okay, so that's pretty much what you get out of a camera.
Right.
Okay.
And so they perhaps could have chose something different, and it still could have been called JPEG.
Okay.
But, you know, within the specification, it really drives what comes out of the cameras. We're really talking about a subset of the broader JPEG specification.
Very interesting.
Now, and one of the challenges there is even though JPEG has defined in their specification both lossy compression and lossless compression, and if we really want to dive into this, there's multiple definitions of lossless that use different algorithms. Each one of these are a different algorithm. It's a different mathematical approach that's used to process the data.
Mm-hmm.
So from the standpoint of the camera manufacturer, it would become very expensive to support the entire JPEG specification.
Okay.
Because it's not like just different variants of one algorithm, it's different algorithms, and so lots more, you know, complexity in the chipset that goes into these cameras, which are very much driven by price.
Okay. And so this has been pretty much, I mean, this whole sort of first generation of digicams is in this mode.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, I mean, all digital cameras today, the standard is JPEG. They all produce
right.
some variation of JPEG files, usually with some control over the amount of compression, you know, the high-quality mode versus the basic mode or a fine mode versus a basic mode. Usually it's just adjusting the amount of lossy compression.
Moving that to something else is a huge endeavor, no matter what the something else might have been.
Absolutely.
But then there were particular ideas about what the something else should be. And there were other contenders that obviously you didn't find adequate because you went off and did something different. So, you know, what were the considerations?
Well, again, we looked at, you know, this broader set of problems. I mean, if you come at it from the premise that, you know, you ask the question, well, is JPEG is going to be it for eternity? Is this the only file format we're going to use?
Right.
You know, our belief was no, absolutely not. At some point in time, you know, we know we're going to want to improve on JPEG.
Yeah.
At the time JPEG was introduced, it was a technological breakthrough. It delivered file sizes, bit rates, you know, based on lossy compression that really made it possible to be able to move around what at the time were very large piles of data that provided a good quality representation of a photographic image.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the amount of data involved was simply unmanageable without this loss, this breakthrough lossy compression technology.
Yep.
But in the process of defining that, you know, a huge number of compromises were made.
Yep.
And, you know, here we are many, many years later, and we've gotten smarter along the way, as is always the case. You know, technology improves, science improves. And so two things are at play here. One, we know we can achieve a better compression efficiency. We just have, we're smarter about those algorithms. We can do greater compression without losing the level of quality. And then, you know, we can afford more bits now, too.
Exactly.
Processors are faster, memory cards are bigger, bandwidth is greater.
Exactly.
So, you know, the groundwork changed.
Which even actually even raises the question of, if you were looking at this from a really long-term perspective, do you just kind of consider bandwidth and storage to be, for practical purposes, infinite? And, you know, should your long-term strategy be, in fact, to you know, not compress?
And that's absolutely a question we looked at. But there, at the same time that memory gets cheaper and disk drives get bigger, other things start happening, which is the classic way we see things evolve, is we move, you know, so we introduce things like wireless imaging,
mm-hmm.
a camera in your cell phone,
mm-hmm.
A wireless connection for your camera that can just beam your photos.
Yep.
You know, through a Wi-Fi network to your PC or even right up to the cloud.
Right. Plus and, just taking bazillions of photos. I mean,
yeah.
There's so many more than...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So all of a sudden, those start cranking in all kinds of interesting new constraints where great compression technology becomes hugely valuable.
Yeah.
If you think about it in the simple case of that wireless digital camera, if I can make the compressed file size smaller, what happens? Well, the camera can hold more pictures on the memory card. So that means that, you know, a memory card, a less expensive memory card could be used, but more I can shoot much longer. My cycle time in the camera can be much faster.
Mm-hmm.
The time it takes to write that compressed data to the memory card is shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And for the camera manufacturer that wants to be able to give you a burst mode, to be able to shoot 3 or 4 or 5 pictures in a row, you know, he needs to put RAM in the camera to buffer that because of the latency writing it out to flash memory.
Yeah.
Well, he can now give you, you know, greater bursts or more. Typically what he can do is drive his cost down because he can use a smaller RAM buffer because he doesn't, the cycle time is faster, so he doesn't have to buffer as much.
Yeah, yeah.
The battery in the camera can last longer because there's less bits I'm reading and writing from flash memory, and hitting the high voltage to set a bit in a flash memory is one of the big power consumers in a camera.
Yep.
And so I can make the batteries last longer. And then you throw wireless into the situation, and you know, transfer times can be faster, which is a better user experience. But back to batteries, anytime I'm turning that transmitter on in a Wi-Fi camera, I'm really sucking battery. So again, it extends battery life. So
we still need to compromise. We just need to compromise better.
Yeah. And we just, you know, how can we apply the best technology we can come up with today, you know, to improve this overall? Now, still the biggest problem, and one that's far from easy to solve and will not be solved quickly, is the fact that the world of photography is JPEG. There's this entire ecosystem built around digital photography, from cameras to PCs to printers that cameras plug into,
yeah,
and digital photo frames and portable media players and kiosks at stores and
photo
Flickr
editors and everything, yeah.
Web services,
yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, as far as that whole ecosystem is concerned, photography is JPEG files.
Yeah.
And so the task of saying, no, we're going to want a new file format to ultimately replace JPEG is just a huge, huge problem. How do we solve that? Well, you don't solve it overnight. You're not going to replace JPEG overnight. You're going to provide it as an alternative, and it'll sit alongside it.
Mm-hmm.
And even so, it's still a very daunting problem. But, you know, in that greater ecosystem, one of the advantages Microsoft brings to the table is we can help tackle a problem of that order of magnitude. If we put it in Windows, we get a pretty wide diffusion of the technology, even if nobody's using it yet.
Right.
It's at least there,
right,
and it's available and ready to be used.
Yeah, so we need to find out more about what HD Photo is now.
Right. So with HD Photo, we looked at digital photography. We said let's think about digital photography from the beginning to the end. What does it need? You know, and throw away the things we don't need for digital photography. And how do we build a file format that absolutely addresses those requirements and do it in a, well, I should say, period, addresses those requirements. Now, there's lots of requirements. I mean, so there's issues of quality and there's issues of features, but performance is important too, because if I can't handle this file format, the encoding and the decoding, the compressing and decompressing in a, you know, $100 digital camera and a very low processor, inexpensive chipset that's inside that camera, then it's not going to be a practical format.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of one of the requirements is computational efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And we really wanted to look at it, again, from beginning to end, because what we see today is the use of this collection of file formats. And so you read the blogs or the forum discussions or talk to someone who's, you know, experienced in digital photography, and they'll talk to you about, no, you don't want to save that in JPEG. Okay, for that stage, you want to use an uncompressed TIFF file. You should use 16-bit, you know. But then when you do this and, you know, versus a RAW file, and it's like, why do we have all these different file formats for these different stages? Well, each one has its strengths and its weaknesses. And, you know, when you understand all those strengths and weaknesses of a TIFF versus a JPEG versus a PNG, you know, versus a RAW file, you can make intelligent choices. Well, our ultimate goal is I shouldn't have to understand that much. I should just be able to be the happy snapper.
Yeah.
Pick up my camera, take a picture, but through the power of great application software, smart software, and powerful PCs, get excellent results. I want to be able to do what I can do in the film world with that throwaway film camera, is just shoot a picture and not have to worry about mode settings on my camera and all these different things. I can just pick up my camera and click the picture and take it, and then I can take advantage of this great power I have in a personal computer to make a wonderful photo out of that.
Yeah.
Or on the other end of the spectrum, you know, is that professional photographer who wants the quality that causes them to use complex workflows with RAW files and other things like that today, but you still get that same level of quality and have that same control over what they do in a simple, easy-to-use workflow, again, with one file format to do it all. So that's our goal with HD Photo. Again, the market ultimately is going to tell us how well we've done in meeting that goal. But at least based on the, you know, what have been multiple years of working very closely with partners, both in the hardware and the software side, we feel pretty good about it. We think we've done it. So HD Photo is first very flexible about the format of the actual image, and we call it the pixel format. So whether it's 8-bit per channel or whether it's 16-bit per channel, we'll support, and it's a long list. We support not just color, red, green, blue color images. We do support monochrome images, too, because there's places you want to do that and use a more compressed format for that. In addition to RGB, we support CMYK, which is format that's used for printers in many cases, and printing is part of this whole photo ecosystem, so we support that. A JPEG is an 8-bit per channel image, so each red, green, and blue has 8 bits, 24 bits total. So for each of those color channels, there's 256 possible values from 0 to 255. And that's not bad, but it is certainly a very limiting factor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, other file formats like a TIFF file can support 16 bits per channel. Now, we support all of that too. But with a 16-bit per channel TIFF file, it's still treated as an unsigned integer value, so that the zero value is the smallest value, and the maximum value, instead of being 255, is now 65535, you know, 65,000 plus. And so I have a lot more steps between the darkest value for a color and the brightest value for a color, but the file still covers whatever I decide is the range, you know, from the darkest to the brightest.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when a camera processes an information, when you shoot a picture in the camera and data comes from the sensor, the actual range of illumination for each color channel is typically broader than what we ultimately save in a file using an unsigned integer format. know, the camera is making a lot of those decisions for us. Is saying, okay, you want a good-looking picture, and I've got a whole bunch of stuff that's way down here in a dark, shadowy area. You don't really need all of that. I'm just going to, you know, make all of that black and set it all to zero. And the same thing in the highlights. You know, you have this range of exposures that the sensor accurately captured, but you know, if I scaled the picture so that that entire range was there, the picture would be very dull and wouldn't have contrast to it. So again, they're going to compress all of that highlight stuff to just white.
And so hence the idea of having a RAW format which delivers all the sensor data.
So the RAW format basically keeps every bit of information that came from the sensor.
Right.
It is sensor data. It's not a photo. That lets the user turn all the knobs and dials themselves to make the same adjustments that the camera makes automatically for you when you shoot JPEG.
Right. So where's HD photo in between those two extremes?
So we've also included support for some new pixel formats that really have never been used before, where we say, let's use 16 bits instead of 8 bits, so we have a broad range, but let's not use those 16 bits just to represent the final range from black to white. Let's use it to represent a wider range that includes everything the sensor could have possibly captured.
Okay.
Within that range, we'll define here's the value that translates to black and here's the value that translates to white. So the camera can do all its automatic processing. In other words, we can have that simple workflow. It can make the decisions and it can produce a file that when I first look at it should be a good-looking picture based on the camera's decision-making. But because we have a numerical range that is wider, you know, broader than the range that we need just to show the image from the darkest to the brightest, from black to white, if you will, or from the unsaturated, or from a dark color to a maximum saturated color for each three color channels, our range is wider than that. So when the camera made the decisions of here's where the darkest point goes and here's where the brightest point goes, it didn't throw away the rest of the data. It's
okay.
Still there in the file.
Okay.
So it gives us the best of both worlds, a file that's as easy to use as JPEG but contains all the full original source image that I would otherwise probably have to use a RAW file in a more complicated workflow to be able to hold on to that information, to be able to, you know, make new adjustments.
Okay. So what it means for a camera to support this format is to understand how to do that.
Oh, yeah, it's
okay.
Absolutely,
yeah.
A kind of different way for the camera to think, and it's not just the camera. I mean, it's a different way for editing software to think.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost every application that you are familiar with today that's used to edit photos thinks about only editing the information from the darkest value to the whitest value and isn't designed to think about having numerical values that are outside that range that when we make an adjustment may come back inside that range.
Okay.
That whole world is known as high dynamic range imaging. And there are applications out there that are specifically designed for high dynamic range image editing and image processing. Photoshop actually supports it. Adobe's Photoshop supports it, you know, in a mode that most people don't use, but it has a 32-bit floating point mode, which, you know, makes it possible to do this high dynamic range imaging. The key is it is a little different way to think about how I understand the data that arrives and how I manipulate and change that data as part of image editing and photo editing.
In addition to this kind of variation in format, there's also, I don't know how to describe it, but kind of a layout approach. So, well, what you talked about on your blog, where you talked about the Sea Dragon technology, which is behind Photosynth, and I guess also now, this is timely, behind the DeepFish browser, right?
It's
or related to
technically
that.
Accurate, no, that's not Sea Dragon, nor is it HD Photo behind it. I think you're seeing the same concept apply.
Okay.
But it's a different kind of a different problem set they had, and so they use a little different technology approach.
But in the Photosynth case, as you were describing it, what the app can do is sort of seek to a place in the image from which it can retrieve a complete compact representation.
Right.
The thumbnails are like tiled into the image, right?
In a way, yes. I mean, so in a typical compressed format, and we'll use JPEG as an example. When I take an uncompressed image, well, I know how that's organized. It's rows and columns, you know, sequentially in a file. So it's not too difficult that if I wanted to get to a particular row or column, a particular pixel, I could compute exactly where I had to jump to in the file to get that data. But as soon as I compress it especially with a lossy compression algorithm like JPEG, but it implies for almost any compression technology, then it really is just this whole pile of compressed data.
Right.
And where one part of it starts and another ends is really unknown from the outside world. And so with a JPEG file, if all I wanted was a small portion of that image, or I wanted, you know, a lower resolution version of that image, I really have no choice but to decompress the entire file, make a great big uncompressed bitmap,
right,
and then resize that to get a smaller resolution, or crop it if I wanted just one region. Well, with HD photo, another big innovation that we introduced with the format is our compressed data is pretty well organized. It's not just this jumble of uncompressed data. We keep it pretty well structured inside that compressed bitstream. So we have data organized by frequency. So, and by that I mean that the information that describes the picture at a low resolution is grouped together, or at least, you know, is it at known locations,
mm-hmm,
and separate from the information that then fills in more detail levels and then even more detail levels. So I can extract a lower resolution version of the photo by simply indexing into my file and pulling out a portion of the compressed data and only processing that subset of the compressed data.
Is it organized at, if you will, multiple zoom levels?
Yes.
Okay.
So in HD photo, we basically have four levels.
Okay.
So there's information that describes each individual pixel, so we'll call that the native resolution. And so that's the information I would have to include if I wanted the full resolution version of the picture.
Okay.
And then there's the information that's at the block level, and a block in HD photo is 4 pixels by 4 pixels. So essentially this is 1/16th of the image size is the information that describes the photo at that resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the macro block level, which is a 16 pixel by 16 pixel organization of the photo. And so that would be a representation that's only 1/256th of the size of the total photo.
Okay.
If I want the full resolution of the photo, I have to grab data from all three of those bands and decode them and to present that. But if I only need a small thumbnail, I may be able to go in only to the lowest frequency band or maybe the top two frequency bands, and I'm processing a dramatically smaller amount of compressed data, and therefore I can do it much, much faster. Now, I said there was four, and that kind of gets into the quality dimension of it, too. So the fourth band is information that describes the fine details of the photo at the finest resolution. And so I only need to process the information from that band to get the highest quality representation. If I'm happy to, you know, get even a full resolution, a version of the photo that maybe doesn't have all the fine details, there's another whole group of data which I can skip or delay the processing. I may display the photo and then add that fine detail later. And the amount of that data that's there is really dependent on the amount of compression I apply. So we talked about JPEG as having lossless and lossy compression.
Yeah.
HD photo has lossless and lossy compression as well, but it's all built into the exact same algorithm. So any software developer or hardware manufacturer that implements support for HD photo always is implementing both lossless and lossy. They're not, you know, you don't have to choose or between the two or do extra work to support them both.
So it's just a point along a continuum?
Exactly. You crank up that quality dial, when you get to the highest level, then it's a mathematically lossless file.
Cool.
So I was talking about this fourth band of this fine detail information. If you're doing lossless compression, there's a lot of information that's in that fourth band, that fine detail information.
Yeah.
If you're doing fairly heavily compressed lossy, that band may not even exist in the file at all. You know, that detail was eliminated as part of the trade-off in lossy compression to reduce the file size.
Very interesting. Presumably, there's also the truth in the file stuff, right? The metadata, which
That's right.
potentially is in multiple formats. So the XIF or the XMP or I forget the third one.
IPTC.
Yeah, that stuff falls in there too, right? Or can be.
It was our fervent goal And when we started the HD Photo project to try to bring some rationality to metadata, let's forget all of these existing formats and all the confusion between them, and we'll define one uber metadata format that's extensible, that's self-describing, you know, that does all of these things.
Yeah.
And we'll use XML because XML is a great way to represent things of this nature.
Yeah.
So if one were to dig back in my archives, you would find all the specifications for doing exactly that.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we didn't. And welcome to the pragmatic decisions that are made in the real world. Two things came out of that. In talking to camera manufacturers, the people that manufacture cameras, they are essentially married to the X metadata. The EXIF metadata schema is what is designed for cameras. It's what cameras currently generate. And so recognizing that the introduction of HD photo would be alongside JPEG as a new feature in existing cameras, it was very important to those camera manufacturers that we maintain metadata compatibility with their current formats.
Right.
So they didn't have this whole new way they had to handle metadata in the camera. And we agreed that made sense. So HD Photo supports, it's optional, but it fully supports having EXIF metadata that's bit-for-bit structured exactly the same way it is in a JPEG file or a TIFF file that contains EXIF metadata. And that provided a huge simplification for the camera manufacturer, and it also is a benefit for software manufacturers who already totally understand EXIF metadata and know how to parse that. And it is today the standard for schema for all the information about the photo from the camera, lens settings, shutter speed, flash mode, flash duration,
right.
You know, all of that type of technical information.
And what about information from me, like the tags that I assigned?
So now we go to descriptive metadata.
Yeah.
Okay. And so for descriptive metadata, again, we had come up with this entire XML-based way to describe this, to make it extensible, a whole schema for that. And after we got all of that done, you know, this was all happening a little about the same time Adobe was introducing XMP.
Okay.
As an engineer, I would point to, well, we did this differently and we think it's better than the way, you know, Adobe chose to do it in XMP. But, you know, by the end of the day, any rational analysis would say that what we had come up with on our own working was pretty equivalent to what Adobe was introducing with XMP.
Yeah.
There was no reason we should try to compete against that and create more confusion. We did what I believe was the absolutely rational and right thing to do for the customer. So we sat down with Adobe and worked together with them.
Yeah.
And so today, XMP is fully supported in Windows Vista, and XMP is the preferred metadata format in an HD photo file.
Okay.
We fully support XMP in HD photo.
You worked together with Adobe on that. HD photo itself is presumably headed towards standardization, but it, for the time being, is something that's been exclusively worked on by Microsoft people. Is that true?
HD Photo comes exclusively from Microsoft. We have announced that it is our intent to submit it for standardization, and that's a process that's underway today.
Right.
I don't have a lot of details I can share on that because standardization is kind of a lengthy and complicated process, so until those conversations progress a little more, and we're dealing with other organizations and other participants in that, and you know, we have to work with those groups. So at the point in time that we're able to say more stuff about standardization, it'll probably come from those, from whatever is the appropriate organization, not even from us. We'll
yeah.
be part of it, but you know, it won't be a Microsoft announcement at that time.
There was some kind of a CNET poll attached to an article about HD photo, and the question was, does the world need another photo compression format? And it came out 48% maybe, but I'm concerned about it being a Microsoft product. 30% no, JPEG works just fine, and 20% yes.
Yep. I was excited and delighted by the results of that poll. A little surprised it was as strongly positive, even that maybe and the yes. Yeah, we need something better. You know?
Yeah. There's been discussion about, at least in the short run, including it within the open specification promise.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I read that that had occurred, but apparently not yet.
No, I think there was a misquote or a misunderstanding in one article at some point in time. But again, here's where we get into a lot of minutia over what is open versus free versus, you know, and the difference between patent rights versus copyrights on source code, you know, and all of those kind of things. And boy, I can't tell you how much I wish all that was a simple thing. And unfortunately, just given the environment we're in today, it can't be simple. It gets a little complex.
Right.
Our goal with HD Photo is to make it completely open.
Okay.
To submit it to a standards organization, to have it be a standard, to make it perfectly possible for an open source developer to implement support for HD Photo. What we've made available today, we've made available without any royalties associated with it. But what we do have available right now today is freely available, and some people call that open, but this is where I want to be clear on our terminology.
Mm-hmm.
It's a device porting kit. The device porting kit includes a detailed technical specification of the compression technology, everything you'd ever want to know about implementing bi-orthogonal lap transforms and, you know, and all the other stages of this is fully documented in the device porting kit.
Right.
And it comes with complete reference source code. ANSI C reference source code for the complete implementation of the encoder and a decoder.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes an end user license agreement that basically, and I have to be careful here because I'm not a lawyer, so anything I say here shouldn't be used instead of what the exact words of the license agreement is, but I'll give you my spin on it as a non-lawyer.
Right.
The goal of that end user license is, you know, there's no royalties associated with it. You can take the device porting kit. You can build it into your application. You can build it into your device. You can sell that device. You can make a profit on it. It even has a provision that you can redistribute the source code. So, for example, a developer who might be providing an SDK toolkit and wants to include support for HD Photo as part of an SDK package that's distributed in source code, you know, might need to redistribute the source code. The caveats that are imposed is that the license is for creating support for HD Photo. So what Microsoft is explicitly not doing with the release of the device porting kit is providing a compression technology that could be used to develop 10 other different file formats.
Right.
So the one constraint in the license is, because our goal is to establish a new file format that we all use, not
right.
to just add more confusion to it. So we've specifically written the license to say, Microsoft is providing you rights to use all of the patented technology that's built into this, and believe me, there's a ton of it. This is really advanced state-of-the-art stuff. But, you know, what you're agreeing to do is what you build will be compatible with the specification. You're
yeah.
going to support the same file format we also.
Help us build out this format. Given that caveat, though, your understanding is that it is, as it stands now, a royalty-free license?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, no fees in any way, shape, or form. So for many people, when I describe all this, they go, oh, it is open. And, you know, but then again, we don't officially meet all the rules for example, development under a GPL license. Because if you start from our device porting kit and you're using our reference source code, well, that still is Microsoft source code. And so what a GPL developer needs is a complete standalone specification only without any source code that they could then, you know, build an implementation
right.
just from a specification.
And they need, in fact, the open specification promise, I think.
No, I don't think they do at all. And again, I don't want to get into all of the gory technical and legal details here, but, you know, again, this is the difference between issues of copyright and, you know, GPL is all about copyright of source code
mm-hmm.
versus patents of ideas and technology.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. There's GPL implementations today for MPEG-2 decoders, but that GPL implementation is not free of the patent royalty responsibility associated with the MPEG-2 technology.
Correct.
So I can go, you know, take the source code under a GPL and use that source code, but I would still have to go to MPEG-LA, who's the licensing authority for the MPEG-2 standard.
About the patent,
and get a license for the patents.
Right.
So in the world of, you know, this is well established in the world of video technology, things, just because something is open and a standard doesn't mean it's free.
These terms have different meanings. And I'm actually, we don't need to beat this to death, but I'm trying to kind of relate this to parallel examples. For example, right. The Office XML stuff.
Yep.
And its relationship to the OSP, the Open Spec Promise, yep. Right?
The trouble with the OSP is it's really too broad for what we're talking about here. But again, this probably isn't the right forum to discuss this.
You know, you're
the
right.
The area we're working on, the intent is absolutely, I think, what you're implying. Whether the OSP is the legal vehicle to do it or not hasn't been decided, and it's not going to be decided by me. It'll be decided by the appropriate people.
And neither of us is really qualified to
figure that out. The fine minutia of legalities that are at play here.
And
the one thing we've certainly seen in the industry, and you see it in the news, is in the area of compression technology. Boy, there's a lot of legal issues one has to be aware of and careful of. And
yeah.
Microsoft is doing its best to do all the right things in that regard.
This is really interesting stuff. How long have you been working on this?
I've been working on it for 5 years now.
Okay.
Again, it was really right off the backside of shipping Windows XP is when we dove into this. This came up as an area, and at the time it's what we call an incubation project. You know, yeah, that sounds like something that really could add tremendous value, but boy, we're not at all sure that it's what Microsoft should or want to invest in right now. So, you know, let's go ahead and do some investigation, do some engineering work, and pursue it. And we really stayed an incubation project for a long time, easily the first 2 years. There were just a couple of us working on the side. And along about 2004, we started getting really serious about it. And one of the big steps was when the printing team was developing what's called XPS, the XML paper specification, which is the whole the file format that's used for the printer spool file format, and is also a form of a portable document format. And they needed an advanced image format so that they could deliver full high dynamic range, wide gamut color information to a printer, all part of this original problem I talked about we were trying to solve. And when they made the decision that they were going to make HD Photo a part of XPS, which it is, that's when things really started ramping up, and there was no doubt at that point in time we were more than an incubation project.
So what devices and or applications today produce this format?
So right now, today, again, we just barely have introduced the format with Windows Vista. So it's we're on the bleeding edge of all this.
So what does that mean in terms of, in what way is it woven into Vista?
HD Photo is fully supported in Windows Vista, but that didn't directly answer your question. You said what
produces
applications
it. Yeah.
Produce it.
Yeah.
There's actually nothing built into Windows Vista that produces image files. The photo gallery manipulates existing image files, and it fully edits and manages HD photo files, but just the nature of it is we don't produce it. Other components in Vista support it. For example, Movie Maker, you can import HD photo files into Movie Maker.
Okay.
Again, it doesn't produce still files, it produces motion files. And there's places where we have holes. It's not, not every last little piece that's in Vista understands the format. The new Expression family of applications from Microsoft, specifically Expression Design, which is the image creation tool, has full support for HD Photo, and the Beta 2 that's of Expression Design that's available free online now, that has HD Photo support built in. Of course, we talked about our friends at Adobe, and we've been working closely with them, and we announced a few weeks ago that we're delivering Photoshop plugins for HD Photo. For both the Mac and the Windows version. And the Windows beta is available for free, and this will be available for free, but the beta is available now and can be downloaded from the Microsoft Download Center.
When do you think you'll get your hands on the first camera?
I can't predict that. We have things happening. We have to. That takes us down another whole path. Is how do cameras get built? Where do they come from? And so, for your typical digital camera that you buy off the shelf, there's really typically three major companies involved in that. There is the camera company who's put their name on the outside of it, the brand name of the camera, and they're responsible for a lot of the features of the camera, the user interface, a lot of the image processing. But they probably built that camera from a reference camera design that came from another company.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of cameras in the market actually are all derived from the same basic reference design, the combination of sensor chip and A to D converter and image processing chips and so on that build up a reference design. And so there are companies that manufacture those. And then those companies license chips from another class of companies. So the actual image processing chip that's inside a camera, with only a few exceptions, comes from a whole different group of companies, names that you and I typically don't hear of on a daily basis. Well, I get to know them all now, but you know, there's companies like Sunplus and MediaTek and Alltech, and well, one of them you probably have heard of is Texas Instruments, is in that business. So to put HD photo in a camera, HD photo has to get put in a chipset.
Yep.
And the chipset has to get put in a reference design, and then a camera manufacturer selects that reference design for their camera. So none of that happens overnight. That's a process. Where we stand right now today is there are at least three different chipset companies, and well, I'm not going to name them all off the top of my head, that have announced support for HD photo in their chipsets.
Okay.
So the ball's rolling. Things are happening. We've yet to see the first demonstrable reference design camera with HD photo, but you know, my guess is we'll see that, you know, at some point in time in the next year or so. But the last thing I want to be doing is speaking for other companies here and what their exact plans are.
Yeah.
The ball's in motion, but there's quite a cycle we go through. So we're probably 2 years away, a year and a half, 2 years away before you'll see a commercial camera that has built-in HD photo support.
Yep.
But that said, you know, I think we're going to see some really cool solutions from third parties. We even have a little work going on at Microsoft that we may do a power toy in this space. It all depends on what the third parties do, where you could shoot RAW files. And then as those RAW files arrive on your PC, the first step is to convert them to HD photo.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, we'll provide you virtually all the same benefits you'd get from having HD photo in the camera, without introducing any real significant complexity to the process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's going to be for a subset of cameras that do shoot in RAW mode.
Right.
And so for the other benefit of HD photo, just, hey, I'm perfectly happy with the quality of my JPEG files, but boy, if you can give me that in half the file size, I get lots of benefits from that. Yeah, that one's a little farther away and will require cameras with that capability built in.
Yeah, although I'm no aficionado at all with respect to this kind of stuff, but in one sense I've never felt comfortable with those JPEG files, which is that I've always known that if these are pictures of my family and are some kind of legacy, then I just hate the thought of throwing away data and not having it for future use, even if I don't have an immediate way to make the most of it, right? So
absolutely. I mean, it's always tough. I mean, there's so many cases, quite frankly, I'll be the first to agree with this, and I know in my case where, you know, it's the subject matter in my picture that's the value, and the technical aspects of how the picture was taken is really secondary, you know? It's the memory. But, you know, what we're really trying to do with HD photo is not to have to compromise on quality and the technical aspects of making a good picture.
Yep.
To preserve that best memory. So, like I say, it's this is not something that's going to happen overnight. But, you know, you mentioned Photosynth and Sea Dragon. Now, there's an example where HD photo was getting deployed, you know, as fast as it went out the door. They were actually first deploying with beta versions, where there's an immediate need to take advantage of the file format to produce something that wasn't able to be done before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it lives in what I described as a walled garden environment. You know, there's no need to make Photosynth work that the file has to be compatible with things on the outside. It can
right.
be converted to and from as necessary. And that's just one example. We're seeing lots of other cases already where people are using HD photo to get those benefits.
Thanks, Bill. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. I learned a lot. I think people are gonna get a kick out of hearing about all this stuff.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun, too.
Okay. Well, thanks. You have a good weekend.